From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in for Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and a little more than an hour from now, President Obama will hold a news conference. In an interview that aired on NPR this morning, the president said the U.S. will retaliate against Russia for cyber attacks that were part of an effort to influence the U.S. election. The man interviewing the president was Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep, who joins us now. Steve, welcome back.
Glad to be here, Jeremy.
And you asked President Obama if the hacking affected the outcome of the election, if Russia was purposely working to help Donald Trump get elected. What did he say?
Well, as far as whether Russia is purposely working, was purposely working to get Donald Trump elected, he withheld judgment on that. We know from sources, NPR and others have reported, that the CIA found that this was the case. Other intelligence agencies have some doubts. And the president is waiting for a formal report from his intelligence agencies before making a statement. But they have put their weight behind a statement that says this was understood at the highest levels of the Russian government, which is pretty close to the same thing. And as far as whether it affected the election, the president says yes. He acknowledges it's not that votes were changed or voting machines were hacked, but he contends that the hack of the Democratic National Committee and of Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, among other things, created a bunch of shiny objects, as he puts it, a bunch of news stories that weren't really of that much consequence, distracted from real issues, and effectively distracted the voters. That's the case the president makes anyway.
And he told you that the U.S. is going to take action against Russia for these cyber attacks. It's pretty clear that he and President-elect Trump are not on the same page about who's responsible or what happened. But does President Obama want to act before Trump takes office? And does he think that anything he does is going to be continued under President Trump?
Well, the current president was definite about one thing. He said, we will respond to this act against the U.S. democratic process, which is the way the president sees it. He didn't say exactly when. He didn't say exactly what would be done. He said that some acts may be public and visible and other acts may never become public. It is known that there's a range of options. You could engage in some kind of cyber attack of your own. You could engage in any kind of propaganda operations of your own. You could in some way try to expose President Putin's personal finances, which is something that's been widely discussed in the media. President Obama didn't go into specifics about what he intends to do, nor did he say when. And I had a lot of questions about that because he's only got a little more than a month in office. And you raised the key question. Whatever he starts to do, if he sanctions some individual, which is another thing you could do, would President Trump continue that? If he takes other acts that can't be done immediately, would President Trump continue them? And what President Obama was able to say is he hopes so, and he hopes that there is a continuity of American foreign policy, even though the president-elect has voiced extreme skepticism about what the CIA is doing and why the CIA is doing it and whether it is some kind of plot against him.
One of the most interesting moments in your conversation was when President Obama talked about how many Republican voters now have a favorable view of Vladimir Putin. Let's listen.
This is somebody, the former head of the KGB, who is responsible for crushing democracy in Russia, muzzling the press, throwing political dissidents in jail, countering American efforts to expand freedom at every turn, is currently making decisions that's leading to a slaughter in Syria. And a big chunk of the Republican Party, which prided itself during the Reagan era and for decades that followed as being the bulwark against Russian influence, now suddenly is embracing him.
Again, Putin is somebody that Trump has praised. Did you get a sense of the Obama-Trump relationship at this point?
Well, the president went on to say that he has had discussions, as we know, with the president-elect, not just their meeting at the White House immediately after the election, but by telephone since then, and that they've discussed American foreign policy. The president talked about the importance of the rule of law and other advantages that he says for the United States, not just at home, but abroad, the reputation, the prestige of the United States abroad. So you have a sense of two men who are talking, but clearly have wildly different priorities, particularly when it comes to Russia. And Obama does note an interesting point. Russia is a very unpopular country in the United States, regarded with deep suspicion going back to the Cold War and perhaps even beyond. But its popularity among some Republicans, not all of them by any means, has risen because Trump has promoted President Putin as someone that he views as a strong leader, or at least a stronger leader than President Obama. Now, we should be fair. Trump has also said Russia has a bad system. He hasn't necessarily praised Russia's system, but he has praised Putin as a strong leader. And some Republican voters are following that lead, which is baffling to the current president.
That's Steve Inskeep, host of NPR's Morning Edition, and much more to come from the interview with President Obama next week on Morning Edition. Steve, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
All right. Well, that debate over Russian cyber attacks has been just burning through social media. Here to look at that and other news that's generating discussion online, we've got Femi Okay. She's host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, and she's on the line from Washington. Femi, welcome back.
Thank you so much. It is an intense debate online. Look out, hashtag Russian hacking, Russian hacking CIA. It almost feels like it's the last days of the presidential election campaign. I noticed lock him up, hashtag lock him up, hashtag treason, all alluding to President-elect Trump somehow being involved in the Russian hacking scenario.
Well, there's also a line from a spokesman from Russian President Vladimir Putin who said today that the U.S. should either just stop talking about this hacking issue or come forward with some evidence that Russia is actually responsible. Have you noticed anything about how this is playing out in other countries?
What I'm looking at is a broader conversation, and it's basically fueled by what's happening in the United States. And it's a very geopolitical conversation, so you will see different netizens taking sides. It's also bleeding over into one of the bigger political stories of the week, and that is what is happening in East Aleppo and Aleppo. And that was basically people in Aleppo grabbing the headlines and saying, pay attention to us.
Right. That basically the rest of us are just watching as civilians desperately try to evacuate the city.
Well, they're grabbing the headlines. They're actually using their own social media and communicating to the world. It's almost unfiltered, though, Peter. I am seeing tweets. I am seeing periscopes. I'm seeing videos from fighters, from civilians. Could this be war propaganda? It's very difficult to check. You need to look at the Twitter handles to see what the Twitter handles are saying. Are they activists? Are they citizen journalists? It's a very murky area, but definitely this was social media grabbing the headlines from traditional media.
Well, and as we know, many reporters and journalists who were not able to get into the city have been using things like social media, WhatsApp, in order to actually do the reporting.
And it's one way of getting a sense of the story, but you're only getting one side or one aspect of the story. For me, I'm circling back to organizations like UNICEF, who in the last 24 hours used hashtag Aleppo. And we call on all warring parties to allow the immediate evacuation of children from East Aleppo in safety and dignity. It's the humanitarian story here, which I think trumps any of the sort of political, geopolitical conversation that's going back and forth online.
Sure. And as that plays out, we also have in this country Facebook outlining some steps that it's been taking to weed out fake news. In fact, they're partnering with fact-checking organizations like PolitiFact, Snopes, Washington Post. Tell us about that. What's the plan?
Well, the plan is to actually get us, Facebook users, to actually help Facebook at least check to see whether a story is true. So now, as well as being able to report perhaps a bad post, you can report that you're seeing a fake story, you're disputing a story. If you dispute a story, then the fact checkers, the third-party fact checkers that Facebook have got on board will then look at a story. If they deem that this story is disputable or fake, it will be labelled with a link and will go further down your newsfeed. It won't be eliminated. You will just know that you are reading and you are sharing what Facebook fact checkers feel is a fake story. They actually are stepping back from saying we're not going to make sure everything is true on Facebook. They say that they believe in giving a people a voice and we cannot be the arbitrators of truth, but at least they're going to help us, the users, work out what is true, what is fake, and knowingly sharing fake stories by labeling them.
Tons of pressure on social media to figure this out. Do you think that'll work?
it's one way of seeing. I'm sure you've seen and I've seen stories and you're thinking, that's not true. And we just laugh and we share it anyway sometimes. It's like, too good to be true. Mm. This is ridiculous. Hashtag fake news. But rather than just do that and allow a story to circulate, there's one more step that we should do as concerned smart citizens. It probably won't work because part of the internet is that the fake stories are kind of fun to look at. But it's when people are using them as information, as was done during the election campaign, that is when they can be quite dangerous.
Well, Femi, we have almost no time left, but I have to mention this story, which is not so serious. The Arctic blast. Folks in Chicago are so cold, they're using a hashtag. Is it Chiberia?
Chiberia 2016. There hasn't just been one Chiberia, Peter. There have been many, and this one is particularly chilly. You should go look at that hashtag, and you will see the freezing memes, the pictures of how people in Chicago are bearing up, but they have been there before.
Yeah.
This is Chiberia 2016.
Femi Okay, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thank you.
You're so welcome.
Dylan Roof was found guilty yesterday on 33 counts of federal hate crimes. A year and a half ago, the self-avowed white supremacist entered the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in downtown Charleston, South Carolina, and during a prayer service, opened fire on its black parishioners. 9 were killed and 3 survived. Alexandra Olgan is covering the trial for South Carolina Public Radio. She joins us now. And Alexandra, you spoke with Reverend Sharon Risher. Her mother, Ethel Lance, and two cousins, Susie Jackson and Tywanza Sanders, were among those killed. She said the hardest testimony for her during the trial was the medical examiner.
Seeing those 6 bullets in my mom's, right at seeing them, I felt like I felt those bullets in the same spot. My body had a jolt.
Hmm. What was the reaction to the verdict?
It was very somber. Your family members were waiting to hear because they read each count, you know, their family member's name and then the word guilty. And then they would nod their heads in agreement. There was some hugging outside the courtroom, but not a lot of celebration because, again, it was still a very somber trial. Dylan Roof, the defendant, just stood expressionless like he has pretty much the entire trial.
And sentencing is scheduled to begin on January 3rd. What can we expect?
So right after the verdict, the judge confirmed with Dylan Roof that he does plan to represent himself and during the sentencing phase of the trial. And he, you know, just gave the judge one word answers, but said, yes, he indicated he understood what he was doing by representing himself. Now, his lawyers have said in a previous court filing that from their experience with other capital defendants, when they want to represent themselves, it might be because they want to prevent some potentially damaging mental health evidence from being presented in court, even though sometimes that would spare their life. So we don't know what to expect from him representing himself.
That's Alexandra Olgan of South Carolina Public Radio. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Earlier this year, we went to South Carolina for the state's primary elections, and while we were there, we visited Charleston and met up with another family member of one of the victims. It was a warm February day, and he invited us into his home.
Hi, Reverend Thompson.
Hey.
Hi, I'm Jeremy.
Hi, how you doing?
How are you? Good to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Thanks so much. This is Dean.
Reverend Anthony Thompson lost his wife, Myra, in the shooting. I asked him to take us back to that tragic night.
I was coming home from my church vacation. We have vacation Bible study. And my wife, of course, was over at Emmanuel getting ready to teach her Bible study. When I got home, usually she'll get home after me anyway. When I came home, as soon as I got in, the phone rang, and it was one of the members from Emmanuel. And she said, well, let me speak to Myra. I said, well, she had Bible study tonight, and she's teaching it. She was like, oh, yeah. And she said, well, hold on a minute. Somebody's on the other line calling me. She came back to the phone, and she said, Reverend Thompson, you need to go to the church. I said, well, I just left my church. She said, no, you need to go to Emmanuel. I said, well, what's going on? She said, I heard some shooting was going on around us. So I dropped the phone. I was in the kitchen, ran out that door. I didn't even lock the door. Got my car, and when I got to Calhoun Street, which is the street the church is on, they had a block. Police was blocking that street. I told him who I was and that my wife was in the church. And he was like, oh, well, they took everybody over at the hotel. across the street, the Marriott. So I was like, oh, thank God, you know, everybody's okay. And I got to the door where they were supposed to be. And when I opened the door, Felicia, one of the survivors, and her grandchild was sitting in the chair. She looked at me, she said, Anthony Myers gone. Good boy. I didn't believe it. You know, I ran out of the hotel and I ran towards the church. Everything was blocked off. I don't know how I got past the policemen and the FBIs and everybody else who was out there, but I did somehow. And I got almost to the door where they were going back and forth, and somebody snatched me. And, of course, you know, I was like, no, I got to go in there. And I identified who I was, and he was like, well, and I asked him, well, what's going on? And he said, well, can't tell you too much right now. I said, well, are they still in there? He said, they're still in there. I said, well, if they're in there, why can't they come out? He said, well, I can't tell you that. I said, you might as well just tell me the truth. Just tell me what's going on. I need to know. You know, of course, I kind of figured it out when this guy, because I've been in that kind of, that, you know, law enforcement, so kind of put things together. I just flipped. I just lost it. I mean, I just flipped. I mean, that's the first time in my life I was uncontrollable. And didn't know what to do. And of course, we didn't find out until 2, 3 o'clock in the morning what actually happened, and that they were all dead and, you know. But I tell you, man, you know, I just cried the whole time. There's just nothing else I can do.
Well, tell us a little bit about her. What do you miss the most about Myra?
Oh, wow. Jesus. Everything. I mean, you know, we were very close. I mean, we, you know, wherever you saw one, you saw the other. And just her mere presence, you know, makes it hard for me to go through the day because, you know, she's always there. I'm always where she is at. And, you know, I miss her calling me, you know, her favorite thing. She walking like, honey. You know, everything was honey, you know. And of course, that's what I called her. And, you know, just her laugh, her conversation. I mean, it's so many things I'm going to miss about her.
Who do you blame for this situation?
I never really looked at it as blaming someone. You know, after it happened, I tried my best not to let Dylan Root be a part of my life in no fashion, no manner, nothing, because I didn't want him to have control over me and my children, you know. So, of course, he's at fault for doing it, but there's a lot of factors that involve, you know, just why this came to be, you know. And it's all about hatred and racism and gun violence. All that has a lot to do with what happened there that night. Dylan was just the instrument to make it happen, you know. So
what would stop it from happening again?
Well, I don't know if anything can actually stop it entirely from happening again, but I know that we can take some measures to try to make it maybe not happen as much as it does, because I realized just how prevalent gun violence was after this happened. And I really started thinking, you know, if we can just, especially in South Carolina, if we can adjust these loopholes, the law, it needs to be a law, you know, mandating that everybody, you know, no matter where you buy a gun from or purchase a gun from, you have to be, you know, an investigation has to be done, a record check has to be done. And I think that would alleviate a lot of gun violence, you know, because it wouldn't be in the hands of the wrong people.
Did you feel the way you do about guns now before the shooting?
Oh, yeah, always did. You know, I was a probation agent for the state of South Carolina for 27 years. And we were required to carry guns, and I never carried one because I found it to be intimidating, and I found it to just provoke people. And then, you know, my local area was right here in Charleston, and I knew these people. I grew up with these people. Some of these people, you know, I went to church with, you know, grew up with, and so I felt like, you know, the gun wouldn't do anything for me, you know. It would just provoke them. So I always felt like I never carried my gun. The only time I used my gun is when we had to go for gun training. After gun training, that closet right there, put it back up on the shelf, and it stayed there until I went again. So I always felt that way about guns. Yeah, always. Yeah.
What did you think when you saw the Confederate flag come down from the grounds in front of the State House?
I was shocked. I was amazed, but glad, because at that particular time, nobody was talking about the flag. Nobody was thinking about whether we wanted up or down. You know, it was something that never really bothered me that much because it was just there as far as I'm concerned. And it didn't mean anything to me. It couldn't do anything to me. So, you know, I decided just forget about it. But when it came down, I was like, thank God. You know, I mean, to me, it was like, well, some good is coming out of this tragedy, you know. And so I was real thrilled about it. And then that's when I thought to myself that I need to do more. And what is it I can do to bring something good out of this bad situation myself?
Well, Reverend Thompson, thank you so much again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Reverend Anthony Thompson, whose wife Myra was among the 9 killed in the Charleston AME church shooting. We spoke with him at his home in February. Earlier today, we caught him on the phone to ask what he was thinking since his wife's killer, Dylan Roof, was found guilty. Thompson said he's waiting to speak publicly until after Roof's sentencing in January. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, first, there were 3 New York City high-rise apartments that took his name off their buildings. Now, a Chicago architect is proposing an installation that would cover the name Trump on the President-elect's hotel and tower in that city. The design? 4 enormous golden pig balloons, one for each of the next 4 years. Max Green from WBEZ reports.
5 letters, T-R-U-M-P. Stamped onto the 16th floor of Trump Tower in Chicago, have been a pain point for many city residents since they went public in 2014. They are huge, 20 feet tall.
And they are grotesquely out of scale with other signs that are posted on buildings in the area.
Blair Kamen has been an architecture critic for the Chicago Tribune for more than 20 years.
So they take what is a civic space and they blight it with this egotistical poke in the eye that is advertising Donald Trump's brand in your face, whether you want to look at it or not. That's what this is all about.
The "this" Kamen is referring to is a proposal by Jeffrey Roberts, principal architect at Chicago-based New World Design. Kamen wants to see 4 bright gold pig balloons floating in the air to obscure the name Trump on the side of the tower. The 40-foot by 20-foot pigs would be attached to buoys anchored in the nearby Chicago River.
And they're far enough away that they aren't going to hit the buildings and such.
Robert says he and his colleagues didn't come up with the design as a way to pick on Trump necessarily, but as a kind of therapeutic post-election exercise. Still, he says the idea has garnered some harsh criticism.
One thing that I'm suspecting is that many people are looking at it and they're seeing pigs and they're seeing Trump. And they're probably interpreting that we're calling Trump a pig. And this is not even close to what we did. It didn't even come up as a point of the discussion.
Robert says the inspiration was actually Pink Floyd's 1977 album Animals. A flying pig on the cover of that record is thought to be a reference to George Orwell's dystopian novel Animal Farm.
The flying pigs, that's obvious that, you know, many of us didn't perceive that Trump would be the victor in this election. So we saw the pigs flying as a component of this.
Even though many Chicago residents might echo Robert's feelings about the election results, Mayor Rahm Emanuel and many of the city's aldermen are working to preserve what is an already strained relationship with the president-elect. During his campaign, Trump called out Chicago by name a number of times, picking on the city as an example of where his law and order candidacy would produce results.
You need more police? you don't have good community relations in Chicago. It's terrible. I have property there. It's terrible what's going on in Chicago.
Dick Simpson is a political science professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago and a former alderman himself.
I think the aldermen generally are upset with all of the policies and the cabinet appointments that have been made so far.
One indicator of that upset is the recent back and forth over an honorary street sign in Donald Trump's name. Citing Trump's stance on immigration, the city council and the mayor voted to have it removed after months of hand-wringing.
We have hundreds of thousands of immigrants in Chicago. We're an immigrant-friendly city, and any threat to our immigrant population will be met with considerable outrage.
As for the four golden pigs, Simpson says it's unlikely they'll fly. But Robert says he is looking at overcoming the technical hurdles.
We're just going to keep thinking about it.
For Here and Now, I'm Max Green in Chicago.
And watching for pigs on the wing.
The leader of the world's largest oil cartel had high praise earlier this week for President-elect Donald Trump's nominee to lead the U.S. State Department. OPEC Secretary General Mohamed Barkindo said this to Bloomberg News about ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson.
He's highly respected around the world. He's deeply knowledgeable. And as I've told other colleagues, there's a very thin line between oil, diplomacy, and geopolitics.
And that thin line has a lot of people concerned. Tillerson says he'll retire as ExxonMobil's CEO at the end of the year. But if he's confirmed by the Senate and becomes the next Secretary of State, he'll represent the United States in negotiations with foreign countries, including at least 24 where ExxonMobil has financial ties. Emily Meyerding joins us now to discuss the geopolitics of oil. She's an assistant professor of national security affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Emily, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with something that Rex Tillerson told Charlie Rose back in 2013.
I think anything that promotes global energy security is in U.S. national interest. And so any steps we take to develop new resources, to promote trading relationships, to promote stability in countries from a socioeconomic, a geopolitical perspective, that is all in U.S. national interest.
What do you think of that? Because the big question that a lot of people are asking about Rex Tillerson is, can he separate his interests as an oil man with the diplomatic interests of the United States?
Well, I think it's true that often, U.S. interests are consistent with U.S. oil companies' interests. U.S. oil companies would like to invest overseas. They'd like to invest in stable countries. They'd like to have secure transportation of global oil supplies. And the United States would also like many of those things. The United States would like to promote oil and gas development overseas. The United States would like secure global oil supply lines. But there are some places where U.S. national interests and oil company interests are not going to be consistent.
So a lot of people would hear you say that and think, well, isn't it an interesting choice to put an oil executive in charge of American diplomacy? Because a lot of people would point out that countries around the globe, including the United States, have a history of going to war over oil. And this is actually a question that you've studied. What do you make of that?
Well, I contest the idea, actually, that countries go to war for oil specifically. Countries certainly do try to improve the security of global oil flows. They try to facilitate global oil production. But the idea that the United States and other countries go to war specifically to gain direct long-term control over other countries' resources, in effect that countries take the oil, the line that President-elect Trump has used, I don't believe that countries actually do that, except under the most dire of circumstances.
But there is a flashpoint here, and it's with Russia. And specifically, critics are looking at ExxonMobil's 2012 deal with the Russian state oil company in the Arctic. Can you tell us about that?
Right. So Russia and ExxonMobil established an agreement between Exxon and between Rosneft, which is the majority state-owned Russian oil company, to explore for oil and natural gas resources in Russia's Arctic. And Tillerson was instrumental to creating that deal. And for a couple of years, Exxon's exploration was proceeding fine. But in 2014, the U.S. and the EU imposed sanctions on Russia in response to its annexation of Crimea. And that forced Exxon's operations to shut down. So ExxonMobil would like to resume those operations, but for that to happen, sanctions have to be lifted. And the concern is that if Tillerson is still acting in ways that are consistent with Exxon's interests, he'll push to lift those sanctions. A lot of U.S. policymakers don't want to see that happen. They'd like to see the sanctions continue to be in place.
Well, put that into perspective here for both the Russian government, which its economy is hurting very badly because of these sanctions, and also for ExxonMobil, because the Arctic is a vast trove of money that has not yet been tapped.
So both the Russian government and ExxonMobil have an interest in resuming operations in the Russian Arctic. The Russian government could certainly use the money from oil and natural gas revenue, and Exxon would like to increase its global oil and gas production. The challenge is, at current global oil prices, working in the Arctic doesn't pay as well as it used to. But Exxon is still likely to pursue those oil and gas interests because eventually they will pay off.
Huh. So with that in mind, how much geopolitical wrangling can we expect over Arctic oil reserves in the future? The Arctic is becoming more accessible to drillers and to many countries that want to be up there. A Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, will have to deal with that.
He will. So far, countries' policy in the Arctic, the states that claim Arctic territory, has actually followed international law. Countries certainly would like to increase the amount of oil and natural gas resources under their control, but so far they've pursued their territorial claims through international institutions. So on the one hand, yes, as oil prices revive, we will see more geopolitical wrangling. But this geopolitical competition isn't likely to escalate to the level of outright militarized confrontations, even though Russia has been has seemed more aggressive in other parts of the world.
Okay, let's take a look at other parts of the world that could perhaps escalate into military tensions or already are. In Iraq in 2011, ExxonMobil defied State Department policy when it struck an oil deal with the Kurdish regional government. Now, the Iraqis condemned this. The U.S. State Department did not like this. And journalist Steve Call, who wrote a book about ExxonMobil, said Tillerson told the State Department after the fact that, quote, "I had to do what was best for my shareholders." What about these deals in the Middle East? Is there anything there that could make his job in the region more difficult?
These deals with the Kurdistan regional government are really at the core of why people are concerned about Tillerson's potential conflicts of interest as Secretary of State. The question is, will he be able to put ExxonMobil's interests aside to pursue the interests of the United States? The deal with Iraqi Kurdistan in 2011 did contradict U.S. government interests. The U.S. government wanted to ensure a stable, consolidated Iraqi state. To make that happen, the Iraqi government needed oil revenue. Exxon's deal with the Kurdish regional government undermined that U.S. government policy. And the fear is, will Tillerson pursue similar interests that contradict U.S. government policy as Secretary of State? Now, there's no evidence to suggest that he won't be able to eliminate his formal conflicts of interests, but will he be able to stop seeing the world through Exxon-tinted lenses?
Right.
That's everyone's question.
Right, right. Well, you said the interests of oil companies and the official policies of the United States around the world are actually pretty often closely aligned. And based on what you just told me, does any of this mean that Rex Tillerson is actually uniquely qualified to do this job?
He's uniquely qualified to deal with U.S. international oil and natural gas policy. He has an experience as a diplomat, effectively, working with foreign businesses and foreign leaders to broker oil and gas deals. On the other hand, he doesn't have experience out of the oil and gas industry. So we may find that his foreign policy focuses more on that industry than previous secretaries of state.
Which is a benefit or a loss?
It depends on who you ask. If you are interested in promoting climate change agreements, if you're interested in human rights, if you're interested in dealing with global terrorism or the Israel-Palestine issue, then his lack of experience in those issues will be a concern.
All right, Emily Meyerding, Assistant Professor of National Security Affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Emily, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And one more note related to this story. The Wall Street Journal is reporting today that Saudi Arabia has hit the pause button on its U.S. investment strategy, and it's considering taking the massive multi-billion-dollar public offering of its state-owned oil company to another country. Sources tell the paper the Saudis are doing this because of Donald Trump's election and because of steps that Congress has taken to allow U.S. victims of 9/11 to sue Saudi Arabia. President Obama vetoed that bill, but Congress overrode him in September. Meanwhile, Trump publicly supported the law. The Journal says the Saudis' move could give the world's largest oil exporter more leverage in its relationship with the U.S., and it is a relationship that a Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, would have to confront if he's confirmed as Secretary of State.
Verizon is reportedly trying to lower the price it pays in a deal to buy Yahoo, after Yahoo announced this week that more than a billion of its customers were hacked in 2013. This follows their announcement earlier this year of a different hack. And these hacks, and others at other companies, are driving up demand for corporate cyber insurance. CNBC's Bertha Coombs joins us from the NASDAQ Stock Exchange in New York. Hi, Bertha.
Hey, Jeremy.
And we read that cyber insurance is now the fastest growing insurance product in the country. How big is this industry?
Well, it's no surprise, right? Because companies are worried about increasing liability. PricewaterhouseCoopers estimates that the market for corporate cyber insurance right now is about $3 billion, and they think that that will more than double by the end of the decade.
And what kind of damages or losses can cyber insurance pay for?
Well, generally, it's a kind of a narrow plan that will look at the cost of complying with reporting regulations. Hospitals, for example, have to report to the Health and Human Services Department when they have a breach. Also paying for the cost of notifying customers, providing monitoring services and things like that. The average payout from an insurance company data breach is about $665,000. That, according to a company called Net Diligence, that looks at cyber risk assessment. But the impact could be a lot bigger. IBM and the Poneman Institute, in fact, they found that this year, globally, the total cost of the average breach was around $4 million. That's up about 30% just in the last 3 years.
And there's still so much that we don't know about these hacks and who's doing them and how they're happening and how much they actually affect. How do these insurance companies figure out what the risk is to actually price out the plans?
That is the real difficult part, because it's not as though you're looking at physical damage. You know, if there's a hurricane, they have years of data to look at how that works. But large companies with cyber insurance right now are getting priced with payout limits of around 10 to 25 million, according to Aon. But it's hard to know what final liability is, because when you think about, for example, Anthem, they got Social Security numbers there over the last couple of years. That's kind of like a cancer cell in a way, because someone could use that years later to steal your identity.
Now, this is something that you do to prepare for a real problem, a big hack, but are the companies themselves trying to stop the hacks in the first place or doing more on the front end?
Yeah, there are a lot of companies. Obviously, they also buy the actual physical detection data, and they're hiring people to do that. But the real key is education and practice. You know, as we saw with the case of Russian hacking during the election, it often starts with a phishing email that looks real, and people fall for it, and they give away their passwords. So there are some companies that do essentially practice. I did a story, in fact, with Cambridge Health Alliance, and they actually send out their own fake emails to test their personnel to see if they'll fall for them. And then if you do more than once, you kind of have to go and take a class and take a whole tutorial. They also do essentially fire drills. They will have their consultants do a fake security breach that no one knows whether it's fake or not. And then that has everyone on the team practice responsiveness, from the IT crew all the way to the public relations department, to make sure they know how to put out a public statement and to deal with this right on the spot, not to wait
Well, Bertha, I have to ask you, because you're at the NASDAQ, that we're seeing, you know, just an incredible run in the stock market and the Dow closing in on 20,000. What's it feel like right now on Wall Street?
You know, it's really interesting. There are those who are saying, well, we're going to get a lot of regulatory relief. That's part of the reason that you've seen this kind of enthusiasm. But there are others who are saying that, to borrow a phrase from one of my colleagues, Brian Sullivan, that this market may be running on hopium at the moment. A lot of people anticipating things are going to be so much better. You know, we heard today from Honeywell that their sales are going to be on the lower end of expectations, even though they think things are going to be robust. It's not as though you're going to turn the key and suddenly you're going to go into Tesla insane mode and the economy is going to grow that much faster that quickly. So there are a lot of folks who are starting to sort of look around and say, you know, maybe you want to think about taking a little bit off the table. There are certainly ways that you can lock in some of those profits. For example, this time of year, if you want to give to charity and you had a big gain on some of your stocks, you might want to donate the stock. You get a double benefit that way because you get those gains, so you get to give a bigger donation, but then you don't have to pay the capital gains on the gain, and you get the tax deduction for that donation. So in a sense, everybody kind of wins off of the big run-up when you do something like that.
Just waiting for somebody to come out with the book, The Audacity of Hopium. CNBC's Bertha Coombs joining us from New York. Thanks, Bertha.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.